Kearney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. Welcome to Democracy Works. I'm Jenna Spinelli. We have a very special episode for you this week. Chris Beam sat down with Tim Miller, former Republican political strategist and the author of Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican road to hell. You might know Tim from his work with MSNBC or The Circus on Showtime. But in this conversation, they talk about the moral motivations and the moral failings of the Republican Party and some of its leaders in the Trump and post-Trump era. This dovetails with some of Chris's work in his most recent book, The Seven Democratic Virtues. And as you may suspect, many of those virtues are lacking in members of the GOP in Tim and Chris's estimation. They also talk about young conservatives and how they may exacerbate some of the dangerous trends that Tim's observed over the past couple of years. We will link to Tim's book and his writing at The Bulwark in the show notes. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Chris Beam and Tim Miller.
Tim Miller, welcome to Democracy Works.
Is it working? It's good to be here, but I'm happy to be on the podcast.
It's aspirational. There's no doubt about that, but becoming more aspirational every day. But that's, you know, that's why you're here. You're going to help us figure all this out. I read your book because it addressed a question that I think is like front and center, right? It's a very important question in terms of figuring out where we are, how we got here, and you know, if it's even conceivable to say what we do about it, right? Yeah. So, what happened to the U.S.? What happened to the Republican Party? What happened to that made tens of millions of people follow this malignant narcissist? And in some ways that's the question of the book, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know if the question of the book is the tens of millions of people. The question of the book is why the people that knew better in the political class went along with such a, manifestly incompetent, malignant narcissist. Because I think that there's a lot of reading out there. I've done a lot of reading that's outside of my expertise about, and there's some global elements to this. Like, why is populism, and demagoguery on the rise other places besides America? What was it about, the shifting nature of our political coalitions that, attracted Trump, that made Trump attractive to, white working class, certain demographics, right? The question of, is this economic anxiety or bigotry or a little bit of both, right? Like, so all of that stuff, I tried to not, go into that academic turf. This is what this is where you guys are. And I wanted to speak more towards, okay, all of that is happening. The question is, there were some people who had the opportunity to make choices that might have helped mitigate all of those other problems, right? Like, had a certain, preponderance of people in Washington and New York made the right decision, made leadership decisions, made decisions where they sacrificed their own self-interest, we might have been able to avert the worst of this, right? I think there'd still been underlying problems we had to deal with, but they didn't do that. Pretty much everybody that I worked with went along with Trump. And, there's some obvious reasons for that, but I think there's some less obvious ones. And so I wanted to, try to get at that question, which is like, why did people who knew better, who are in positions of power, be that in positions of influence in the media or positions of power inside the political apparatus, why did they go along with something they knew was so hard, was so potentially disastrous. And so I did a bunch of interviews and kind of reflected on my own career. And the first half is more of like a look back at, the modern Republican Party. And then the second half is a look at why, because I didn't do it, why my peers continued to go along with Trump once he won the nomination.
No, I think that's gets us to the nub here, right? We are not talking about the unemployed steel worker in Youngstown.
Right.
We are talking about really the people that the unemployed steelworker in Youngstown hate, right? We're talking right. about the cultured elite, right? The coastal right. elite, right? Yes. These are people who are not afraid, you know, about the condition of the trajectory of the country. They're not afraid about the collapse of, you know, a Christian moral establishment, nothing like that.
These
right?
people's lives would have been completely, not only just fine, but still wonderful if Hillary Clinton had become president. Like that's really the fundamental element to this. Like, why was it so hard for people just to say, man, in this one case, this has gone over the line and we just need to unite together and say no to this dangerous demagogue and we can live to fight another day in 2020, right? You know, not in the political consulting class, the media, you know, even if you just look at the types, there's very few of us, right? Like, looks at the types of people that did do the right thing. You know, Bill Kristol started the Bulwark with us. Jeff Flake, you know, he's ambassador to Turkey. You know, right. Bill has a nice life in suburban D.C. Was the way to maximize your earning potential and influence to go along with Trump? Absolutely, right? But were these people at risk of any threat to their person, any threat to their financial stability? Like, no. I kept interviewing like more like mid-level consultant types, and they'd say, well, you know, I got college, you know, is going to cost a lot for my kids. And it's like, anyone could have just said, hey, I'm going to vote for Hillary and I'm going to go work for Facebook. Any of these people, right? Like, these are not people that are economically insecure in any way. And yet, you know, they still decided to go along with this just atrocious thing because it was the easy way to go. And it was probably the more, and it was certainly the more lucrative option. And there are other factors at play too.
Right. So, as I, and when I reach out to you, this is what I said, I see like three kind of buckets in terms of explanations.
Yeah.
One is kind of human nature. One is kind of the craven moral cesspool that is DC. And then three is kind of something distinctive about the Republican Party. And I wonder, I mean, I don't want to go, are there other buckets?
Yeah, I mean, the fourth one, which would maybe fall into, you know, as a subgenre of the first or the third bucket, the thing that most surprised me is, within this elite set, there was a peer-based grievance that was a lot more deep-seated than I realized. And maybe some of that is part of human nature, but I don't know if that's what you were referencing, right? Like this notion that, I might be financially well off, but the liberals, the progressives are ascendant culturally, you know, they get invited to all the good parties, you know, they're the ones who get praised and get awards given to them. Meanwhile, I'm over here, you know, being successful, sure, but like my wife's friends hate me and think I'm a racist now because I work for Republicans, and you know, I the media is mean to me and I don't get a fair shake. And because I'm a white guy, maybe I didn't get appointed to this, board of prestige mm-hmm. that maybe I would have been, right? So, like that element. What that kind of interpersonal grievance within intra-elite, set was kind of the most surprising thing to me when I was hearing from people, because I was expecting the inertia. Oh, this is my career. This is what I've always done. I was expecting the Republican Party has kind of trained us that like that this is all a big game and that the beating the libs is the most important thing. I was expecting the money defense. Oh, I need to pay for my kids' college. Like, I wasn't quite anticipating just how like rotted the soul was when it came to just the kind of the schoolroom cafeteria element of all this.
That's exactly where I was going to go, because you talk a lot when you're talking about specific people. You talk a lot about how these folks were not the most popular kids in high school or in college, right? Yeah. And that there was some kind of, you know, just kind of this was their shtick, right? That they dress up like Alex Keaton, which is a reference that nobody under your age is going to get, let alone.
You know. Yeah, barely my age. I was very young. I think the only reason I get the reference is because I was Alex Keaton.
Fine.
You know, but I think that really, it's quite an old show. But
yeah, but you get the point is that these are kids in college or high school and college who were on the outside of the elite in those worlds, right? Right. And it, you know, and I have to tell you, when I was reading this, I was thinking about something. My mother is in a, in a senior home, and the woman there said that the dining room there is like high school, and I'm like, oh God, kill me now.
Come on, really?
That it's the same kind of dynamics and the same kind of. Who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down, who's friends with who's pissed at who. And you know, I kind of get the sense from reading what you talked about, like Sean Spicer and Ryan Priebus, that because of that happening at such a formative moment in our lives, that it just never goes away.
Yeah, there's just this hole of like in people of wanting something, right? And I think the thing that is bipartisan about this, and trust me, I do talk plenty in the book and we can in this interview about the unique Republican elements to this, but is that DC, you know, the kind of the drug that gets people excited about DC is this access to power. Right now, there's a certain type of person for whom it's actual power, right? That they like being the one making the calls, but that's almost like a different psychological category. It's the being around power, the proximity to power. Like that's more the fun part, right? Because you don't have to make any decisions. It's you know, getting to go into the Oval Office, getting to talk to your friends about it, getting to post about it on social media, right? Like that, getting to fly on Air Force One. All of that stuff is the drug that drives a lot of these people, and many of them were not, right? It's just the types of people that were very interested in politics in college, that were in the speech and debate team, you know, that got good enough grades, right? Like to go into all of this, it was not necessarily a very clean overlap usually with the types of people that were, you know, whatever, on the football team and got invited to the cool keg parties. So there is this in DC, just, you know, it's most grotesquely on display during the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the nerd prom, where everybody's just so excited. It's like these third tier actors are coming from Hollywood and everybody's like, I want to be by them. I want to be with them. I want to be invited. And they're just, you know, and so I think this is like one thing about the book that I tried to get at. I think people sometimes misdiagnose this is all about money. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that people just, you know, there was money to be made. And so people did it. And like, that's really more of like a New York kind of thing. Right. The DC crowd, the access was more important. And you have this hole in you. If you don't feel like you were recognized, you don't feel like you were seen growing up, you didn't feel like you got invited to things. And now all of a sudden you are. Right. Like you're not just getting invited to the White House. You're getting called by heads of studios and senators and media, and people recognize you in the airport because you're on TV. And that, you know, and you're just constantly filling this hole inside of you with like all of that recognition that you never got before. Trump gave a lot of B, C, D list people the opportunity to get that recognition that they hadn't gotten. And they got the added bonus of they got to put their finger in the eye of the people who they thought had been getting the recognition in an unearned way, you know, the Obama people and the Clinton people and stuff. And it's like, now I'm the one that gets to go on Air Force One and I'm the one that gets, you know, recognized. I think if you, misunderstanding that misunderstands kind of what the appeal of that of Trump was to the Spicers of the world.
And then the problem is, I mean, you know, this is a hole that cannot be filled, right? I mean, and especially so in this case, because even though they had this, even though they were on Air Force One, the cultured elite still didn't think it was nearly as impressive because it was Trump, right? And so all that did was like, well, add to this feeling of resentment. Right?
Yes.
And to say, all right, well, then I'm going to up the ante yet again. Right.
Yes. And this goes to what I tried to get at about, like, why didn't people jump off eventually? You know, it's almost like you can almost understand. I mean, for me, Trump was so repulsive, it was just not possible. But you can almost understand why somebody could just justify in early 2017. Yeah, man, I can go get this job. I can be the spokesperson for the State Department. I can travel around the world and I can get this job I never would have gotten for anybody else. And it's going to make me feel important. It's going to help my future career prospects. And, you know, I'm going to get that recognition that I'd lacked. And then you get in there and Trump is just, it's even crazier than you even thought it could be. And you're not getting the recognition. In fact, the opposite. You're getting attacked and insulted, and people in your life are being mean to you, and you're losing friends over it. And that does stir up that resentment, you know, in a way that kind of boomeranged them into feeling like they wanted to even grasp tighter to mm-hmm. this thing that they weren't even 100% sure about, right, to start with, right? Because it was like, okay, now you have this bunker mentality. Now it's like, I got to prove these guys wrong, even more wrong. And so I just, when I was doing these interviews, it just was alarming to me how many people cited this kind of thing, that they were just like, now it's been a little while, so I don't have this exact quote right, but it was like, someone said to me essentially, you know, I felt like I had no choice but to hold on to the one or two things that I agreed with him about, you know, and block out all of the rest, you know, in order to justify and rationalize like my need to keep doing this, right? Essentially, right? It is like I was so mad, I was so resentful to all the people that were telling me that I was a bad person for going along with this, that it almost thrust me into his arms even tighter. And that's, you know, in the second to last chapter of the book was with Alyssa Farah, who I think people have different views on. Some have problems with her, but she did leave at the very end, you know, too late for many people's taste, including mine, but she did leave in the end. And I tried to kind of grapple with like why she was able to kind of separate herself while so many other people couldn't.
You know, my human nature bucket is, you know, referencing the sunk cost bias, right? Yeah. That when you're in, when you've made a commitment to a strategy, and this can be anything, right? You know, this happens on Wall Street all the time. And it happens in sports when you get a team that said, this is our strategy. We're going to do this. And we're going to, even though it's obviously not working, we're not going to change it. Right. Yeah. And so you can see that, but it's also in terms of, you know, this required kind of doubling down on a sense of personal identity.
Yes.
And what tribe you're in. And so there's this, you know, deeply existential dimension to this. Yes. You know, what exactly, or maybe it's better to say, what are you not giving up by walking away from this? Right? I mean, yeah, you still have, you know, resources, you still have, you know, your Ivy League education, whatever. But you have made, you've defined yourself in terms of, you know, who you're connected to. And to walk away from that is, you know, for anybody, an incredibly difficult and terrifying prospect.
Yeah. And this is true. This is one of the things that, as I was writing the book, scares me most about what's happening society-wide right now, because I don't know if this was really so much of a thing 20 years ago in the 90s when I was growing up, that like people like identified themselves as part of a political tribe as a core part of their identity. And I think that they do now. But it was always the case in Washington, right? And so these people, their friend groups were based on their party. The bars they went to were based on their party. Their poker nights were based on their party. I joked, but it's true. I know multiple people who named their daughter Reagan, who lived in Washington, right? So like you have like literally your child's name is attached to this tribe. And so, okay, now if you step away, and not just to step away and say, oh, I'm going to go do something else with my life now. You know, I want to be whatever. I want to, you know, I'm going to own a winery or, you know, I'm trying to think about other jobs. I'm going to go do PR for Corp for United or whatever. I'm going to go like open up a restaurant. That's one thing. But to step away and say, no, I'm stepping away not because I want to do something else, but I'm stepping away because that thing that was part of my identity is actually bad. right?
Right.
I made a bad choice. Yeah, yeah.
That's something flawed. I backed the wrong horse.
That's very challenging, right? Yeah. And because then it's not just you have to accept that you made a bad choice, but you have to like admit it to everyone in mm-hmm. your group, and they all made the same choice. And so mm-hmm. now it has an impact on your interpersonal relationships. They look at you differently, right? Like I can see it. So my life ended up being fine, right? I write in the book about how I'd come out of the closet already. So I'd already made big identity changing things that worked out great for me. So maybe it was easier for me than for others. But I can see this. You know, I still feel it sometimes with my conservative family members, you know, that I feel like look at me a little differently. They were so proud of me. Right. Like they told their friends about me. You know what I mean? You're talking about your mom and the thing, my grandma in the senior citizens home, like she would, cause I would go on Fox, right. Which is what they watch. So she'd be like, she would tell her friends about me. Right. And now she doesn't tell her friends about me. Right. You know, like that's little things, but I had, I joked that I had the wedding. I got married to my husband in 2018, 2 years after Trump. I was always worried that people weren't going to show up to my wedding because it was a gay wedding. That I would have conservative family members or friends who wouldn't feel comfortable. To my knowledge, nobody didn't show up for that reason. Several people didn't show up because they were former colleagues of mine that were mad at me over my Trump apologia. And I was like, we're living in the upside down here. If you had told like high school me that you're going to get into a gay marriage and the people aren't going to come because you didn't support a political candidate, you know, the whole thing is just very strange. So those are just a couple of examples, but you know, you just project that out onto a group. You know, this tribal element is so part of human nature, and it's so intensified in Washington that I do think that it, you know, what might seem very easy to say no to such an obvious moron bigot, you know, carried with it a lot of weight that was attached to people's personal identity. And it reminded me of the Catholic Church. My family's Catholic. And with that, with the Catholic Church, with the scandal around that, right? I saw some similar parallels there with my family because it was like they didn't want to accept, right, mm-hmm. that there was mm-hmm. this bad element. Maybe there's a Penn State parallel. I don't know.
I mean, at some point, you know, most human beings are confronted with that problem.
Right.
And you know, and how you address it and whether or not, you know, and whether or not you just rationalize it or you compartmentalize it. There's lots of strategies that we all have for dealing with it. Something you said, I think is another kind of place that I wanted to get to.
Sure.
And that is, you know, when you're talking about DC and this kind of, you know, the hacks of the world, the campaign operatives, has it been forever thus or not? You know, and on the one hand, you have, you know, I mean, I think it was Truman who said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog, right? So it's not wrong to think that this is, you know, this is a world where self-interest overrides just about everything else. And this is the way the game is set up. And this is how we determine winners and losers.
Yeah.
And so that's just how people are going to operate. On the other hand, you know, I know that you know stories about, you know, I mean, Reagan and Tip O'Neill would hang out together and drink together. And there are stories about, U.S. reps getting on planes after they had just ripped each other and then going back home and sitting in the back of the plane, you know, just emptying those little bottles one after another. And it was like they were able to compartmentalize, right? Yeah. Or at least see that as maybe part of the game. But I don't know that that's true anymore. I don't think it's true anymore.
Yeah. I don't think it's true for a lot of reasons. So I would answer this by saying, look, I think that in some ways it was always thus and maybe is unfixable, right? But there were bumpers around it. If you look at George H.W. Bush, who I greatly admire, right? I'd worked for Jeb, who admired his dad so much and, you know, have read his letters and his private correspondence. You know, that's been published since his death, and I haven't read any secret correspondence. You know, he so often did the right thing, right? Like at times, especially after he's in the presidency, you know, at times that that maybe hurt him a little bit politically. He was thoughtful and caring about other people in his, you know, people, Democrats in the other party, and would write to them. And obviously his letter to Clinton, right, you know, was so magnanimous. But he also was at the RNC during the Nixon impeachment. And if you go back and read some of his defenses of Nixon, it's pretty cringeworthy. You know, it's pretty cringeworthy, but yeah. And he also hired Lee Atwater, who did some, right. So, you know, there were these, you know, the two wolves inside him. Right. And so like, to me, it's more of a question of whether, you know, there is this balance, right. And there is this consideration, right. That politics is always going to be a competition at some level. But, you know, if you go back to the Nixon era, maybe HW didn't do the right thing, but there were, Nixon's resignation was because members of his own party, you mm-hmm. know, were willing to go speak out against him, right? And so I think that some of the things that have changed now are, number one, I think in the mass media age, and I write about this a lot, the extent to which people treated politics as a game in the lead up to Trump, really, I went on to hyperdrive, right? Mm-hmm. I think there were, you know, you could come up with these examples of the Lee Atwaters of the world, but they were more the exception to the rule. And I think that became a much more widespread, you know, element. I also think that certain things about politics changed, the incentives changed, social media, cable news, campaign finance reform, a lot of the things that kind of kept collegiality, you know, the way you gained power in old Washington was really through collegiality and being serious, right? Like demonstrating that you could lead a committee, demonstrating that you could gather a group together, get a bill passed, right? That the way you gain power now in Washington is by being a clown, particularly on the Republican side. This is once a time where like that it's especially true on the Republican side, right? By getting on Fox the most, by, you know, by saying the most outlandish things so you can raise fundraising dollars on it. So I think that there is some through line, you know, from whatever Nixon to now about just Washington being a cesspool. But I think that we have really put it on a hyperdrive in the past, you know, 20 years.
Yeah, no, I actually, one of the stories that came to my mind when I was reading was Michelle Bachmann went into, you know, kind of extreme, let's not say insane, but let's say extreme U.S. rep from Minnesota Republican, went into Boehner's office, Speaker of the House then, and said, I want to be on some major, I think it was Ways and Means.
Yeah.
And he's like, hell no.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely not. And she said, all right, well, then I'm going to go on Fox tonight, and I'm going to raise enough hell that you're going to do something. And I mean, it speaks exactly to your point, right? There is an avenue to power, especially in the Republican Party, not exclusively, but particularly, that has completely overridden the kind of status quo pattern for developing power in D.C.
And then you get the self-selecting element to it. And I think that just really quick about the Republican Party, and I think this is two things just to understand the problem and look at where we're going. Because it's a different problem. The part of the reason it got us into the Trump world was that I think that the Republican campaign self-selected really for people that were more cynical. And I think that it was mainly just because people that are pure ideologues, conservative, Christian conservative types, just like aren't really the types to go get campaign jobs, right? It's just like the nature. And the people that were getting Democratic campaign jobs were like, you know, West Wing, Obama, Ernest folks, right? And so I think that on the Republican side, you saw a lot of people that like were really almost nihilistic. You know, mm-hmm. that chose to go into that because it was like, I like politics, I like the competition, and, you know, whatever. And I write in the book about a guy who revealed to me during the interviews that they've never voted for a Republican for president. What? And like, this is at the high level of power, but he just likes the rush of it all, right? So I think that that's something a little different. Now, I think that is getting exacerbated to a great degree. If you look at the type of people that are self-selecting in to the Donald Trump party, like think about, you know, I don't want to insult any students at Penn State, but think about the type of person who's 2022, who's like, I like politics. I'm maybe kind of ideal. You know, I'm ideologically, I'm forming my ideology. You know, I'm not talking about the kids that come that are super, you know, already ideologically formed, but I want to go work in Washington. I want to go work in campaigns. The type of person that's going to say, yeah, I'll go take a job for the RNC, like during the Trump era, after Trump, it's a different type of person. It is somebody that has accepted that they like that they're cool with the trolling and the mocking and the cruelty. And so I worry deeply about like the self-selection of who is who's choosing to enter, you know, right now. And I think that's true from like the entry level jobs all the way through candidates.
Right.
Like what kind of candidate wants to run? You know, I always say I get calls, frankly, from people who are conservative mainstream. They're like, should I run in a Republican primary? And I basically have to tell them no. And I said, you should do what you want. I'll support you. But there is just not a path for you unless you, you know, are willing to debase yourself for Donald Trump. That has an effect on what kinds of people are going into Washington. So this is an ongoing thing that I think is actually getting a little worse over time.
You have this pot of explanations and phenomena that are just all mixing together to make it very difficult, not only very difficult to get out of, but also exacerbating it, right? I mean, that you do have, you know, people doubling down and people feeling unable to escape. And, you know, if you look at not just here, but throughout the country, if you look at the leaders of the college Republicans right now, it's a type. And I don't see that going away because there's no other way to be a young Republican right now.
Yeah. Spoiler, this might be coming to a future book near you. But I feel the same way. I'm deeply concerned about the young Republican element to this and how that's going to move over time. To the first part of your comment, question about the Democrats, I do, like I said, I think that there are some unique elements in the self-selection of the types of folks that are working in the Republican Party and the types of tactics that Republicans used. And we haven't even talked about that much about the conservative media world, which is a unique beast and animal. So I think there are a lot of things about the Trump effect, you know, what happened that was unique to the right. The two things that make me concerned, you know, are one, just the human nature parts of your bucket are true across human nature, right? Sure. Inertia, you know, if some insane leftist, you know, took over the Democratic Party, there would be some people that would succumb to inertia and succumb to careerism and, right, succumb to, you know, wanting to have access to power, right? Like it's not just right wingers who have those weaknesses. But the more acute thing that worries me is the tendency to, you know, to put on your team jersey and decide that everything about the other side is horrible. And so I don't even need to engage with any retrospection about it. I see this happening on the left for good reason, by the way. The Republicans don't deserve a lot of consideration, but I worry how one of the key rationalizations, this was not true for everybody, but there were some people who went along with Trump because they had so internalized that the Democrats are bad and evil. And if the Democrats are bad and evil, that justifies any action to defeat them. And I worry a little bit about the development of the inverse of that. I think that there are some things that the Democrats have some antibodies against that. For example, the left-wing media ecosystem is much more heterodox and much less, Pravda-y than the right-wing one.
Right.
And it's also more of a diverse electorate, and I think it makes it a little harder for a demagogue to take over when you have, you know, very diverse constituencies, both religious, you know, academic, racial, et cetera.
All I want to say is that I think your book and your work are a real service in that regard. Not to say you can't be wrong. Of course, we can all be wrong, but you are committed to telling the truth, and even when it's not flattering to yourself necessarily, at least in your past self.
Yeah.
So I just want to, you know, I want to commend that, and you know, not just for yourself, but also as an example to all of us. I think it's the only choice it's the only alternative we have to what's going on, is to just reflect reality as we genuinely understand it.
Thank you. I'm doing my best to do that. It's very freeing. I think it is the one thing. It's my best understanding for why liberals care to hear from never Trump, anti-Trump Republicans, is I worry that the dark angel on the shoulder is because it flatters their biases, and I think maybe there's something to that. But I
of course there is.
Yeah. But the other reason, though, is that I think that we have a freedom to kind of to say what we really believe without thinking about career, whatever implications, because, you know, we're kind of shot at this point on that front. And so even some of my Democratic friends say that they appreciate, you know, that I can kind of go out and talk about this stuff with in an unvarnished way, that sometimes they feel like they have to, you know, choose their words a little more carefully, right? Because, you know, they're thinking about, who knows, like, I don't know, the next Democratic president might call me and I, you know, I don't want something out there that is going to make me look bad. And so anyway, I hope that the latter reason is as much of it as the former, and I'm doing my best to just not BS people anymore, at least.
Well, it's a good and fortunate position that you've got yourself into, but you came by it honestly, and obviously it took a long way to get there. Yeah. So anyway, Tim Miller, thanks very much for your time and for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm always happy if there's a student or whatever that wants help, you know, an intro or help or 2 cents. I'm happy to do it. So thanks for reaching out.
Great. Thank you.